I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Joan Logie. She is the Poet Laureate of Santa Fe. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
So you have been the Poet Laureate for a couple of years now?
Yes, I have 2 months, basically.
Give or
take a few days left, yes.
And what are the duties and responsibilities of the Poet Laureate?
There are 4 public appearances, which may be with the mayor, or we did visits to nursing homes on Valentine's Day with a whole group. That was one of my public appearances. I spoke at the Santa Fe High graduation last year as a keynote. So there have been a variety of city council. So 4 public appearances, and I've written poems for all of those events.
Oh.
And then an educational component, and mine was a show called Joan and the Giant Pencil with Jeremy Blyke, and we went into schools, and it's something I'd... One of the nice things about Poet Laureate is I took things from the back burner and brought them to the front burner, and I'd always wanted to do a show for kids, how I fell in love with poetry as a child.
Ah.
So I picked some of my favorite kid poems, and I still have my book my mom gave me when I was a kid. And The Giant Pencil of Kathleen McLeod comes with us, and Jeremy's on Trash Can Lid, and he composed music for these poems, and we're going, we have 2 or 3 more schools left in the season this year we're going.
Now, I think that's an interesting idea. You've got all this back burner stuff.
Yes.
What do poets put on the back burner?
Oh, you know, I have so many poems that haven't gotten out of notebooks into text. And I think this is something about grants and awards. It sort of makes you stand up. So I was typing things up like crazy. I was keeping running commentary in poetry throughout the years, particularly the first year, to kind of do the cycle of Santa Fe and, you know, do Spanish Market, do poems for different occasions. So it just made me sort of stand up straight. And and then I had this other twinkling, which we can talk about.
Which we will talk about.
Yeah.
Let's stay with this for a second.
I think
when you become Poet Laureate, and we live in a culture that is not exactly, I mean, maybe New Mexico more than other places, but the United States of America is not exactly known for being a poetry-loving place compared to a lot of other cultures that where poetry
right.
is really important and all the poets are well-known and well-loved and they draw stadiums full of people and stuff like that. Nevertheless, here you are, Poet Laureate. You become a public figure, and that's a very interesting place for a poet to be.
It has been such an honor. I mean, I've been doing poetry in various community ways for 30 years, and this is such an honor, and people kind of know who I am, and my husband's been very sweet and supportive, although he may be getting a teeny bit weary of it all.
2 months left.
Yeah, 2 months left. The minute I'm done, he's going to Peru. So
let's talk about how you actually fell in love with poetry as a child. This is something, a story that you've told to kids here in Santa Fe.
My mom read to me. My mom was not a college graduate. She had she basically had a beauty salon because her money went away in the stock market crash, so she could only afford to go to beauty school. But she knew about education. Neither of my parents had college. So she read me. She bought me books. I was home a lot by myself because, you know, with help watching me, she was always gone. But I was surrounded by books, and I had poetry books and Robert Louis Stevenson. And so they were my companions, my dog, Chips. But so, you know, I loved it. I loved the sounds. And I read about Dylan Thomas, that he fell in love with the nursery rhymes, and I kind of did as well.
Nursery rhymes, I suppose, are the poetry that we all have in common.
Well, I wonder if kids do now.
Really?
I would love to just, I mean, I so I took my love of poetry from the back burner to the front burner, and I want to, you know, when I'm done being Poet Laureate, I still want to go into the schools and, you know, maybe even preschools and do nursery rhymes.
Are parents not doing this with their kids at bedtime?
I don't really know. I mean, we're so culturally diverse, and the nursery rhymes come from England. They're Anglo culture, and
right.
I'm sure people have their own traditions, but traditions are going by the wayside, so I'd like to keep all
very my... interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not quite sure who I would be without the 2 Winnie the Pooh poetry books that preceded Winnie the Pooh and the House at Pooh Corner.
Yes, and one of the poems I read to the kids is James Morrison,
Weatherby George Dupree.
And it's such an odd poem, but they love it.
I know.
And Jeremy's on the trash can lid in the background.
So what have been some of your favorite moments as Poet Laureate?
Oh, great question. I got to do a lot of intros this year that I might not have been invited. I got to introduce Arthur Z, who was the first poet laureate. That was great. Mary Oishi from the radio world and poetry world in Albuquerque, Tom Ireland. But two really spectacular intros that I got to do were Annie Lamott, when she was here about a year and a half, and I just adore her, and I worked. It was like, you know, it was like my PhD in intros. I had the best time writing that, and she appreciated it. And then I was in Boise, Idaho a year ago, exactly this week, and I got to introduce the then U.S. Poet Laureate, W.S. Merwin.
Nice.
And he's coming to Santa Fe next week, actually.
What was that like?
He was so warm. I was nervous, but I just did it. And it was in a theater called The Egyptian in Boise, Idaho, that's like just like Arlensic, you know, very ornate and beautiful. He couldn't have been more lovely, and he asked for a copy of it, and he read so beautifully about the imagination. That was his topic. And the reason he chose to be poet laureate is so that he could talk to people about that.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. So being poet laureate, I guess all sorts of states and cities have their poet laureate, and the United States has its poet laureate, and there's this whole...
Yes, it's Philip Levine now. We're so happy. They've been choosing unbelievably great people. I mean, you know, another guy in his 80s.
Yeah,
another guy in his 80s that's just so brilliant and working class in his subject matter and background.
Right. So what are some other favorite moments?
Well, I've been encouraging other places to start poet laureate programs. I did when I was in Idaho. And then actually some friends in Albuquerque loved what they saw happening in Santa Fe. And this Saturday, I'm going to go down, and they're going to announce the poet laureate in Albuquerque.
Nice.
So I thought I was a little bit of an instigator. Valerie Martinez, the second poet laureate, is very involved in that process. So,
yeah.
So that's kind of cool because, I mean, everybody brings their own style to this position. But it always has a literacy component. So I think it just is a good role model in community. And should I give you another favorite
yes.
thing? Okay, so we're going to talk about an ongoing show at the Santa Fe Community Gallery. And there's a part of this show that was my favorite moment.
This is Odes and Offerings.
This is called Odes and Offerings.
Odes and Offerings is at the Santa Fe Convention Center, the Santa Fe Community Convention Center, I should say, gallery. And the gallery there is open for, Tuesday through Saturday.
Tuesday through Saturday. You can check the hours, but if you go between 10 and 4, you're really safe.
Yeah.
It opens to 5 on some of the days. So Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4, I would say, is safe. And I really hope everybody in Santa Fe checks it out. So I had this little twinkling, kind of an extra. Wouldn't it be interesting to invite the visual artists, and the community gallery is aligned with the Arts Commission, with the Poet Laureate Program, and Rod Lampert is the director there, and he's been really fun to work with. And so I curated 36 poets, like 35 and myself. I could have invited 56. I know, so I felt it was very hard, and
yeah.
I lost a lot of sleep over that because I'm sort of a worrier.
You don't want to exclude any people whose work you think is wonderful.
Every time I'd see somebody, I would just go, oh, you know. So anyhow, I did it on all my relations. Whoever I ran into, I invited, and that's how it was. So 36 poets, and then the gallery put out a call about this show that poets were going to be paired with visual artists, and we were asking for text to be incorporated in each piece of work. Not an inspiration, but an actual using text in the work. So they have a application process and a jurying process. So they juried 36. I was not in charge of that. But what was fun is Rod and I sat down with 36 poets who I knew their work. I'd been really working hard on their work. And we got to pair them with the visual artists.
Oh, my goodness. That is an act of matchmaking that's profound.
It took us 2 hours. It was so much fun. And I only made one mistake. Two of my very closest friends, Judith Hill and Miriam Sagan, I gave them the absolute wrong people, and I called up in the first thing in the morning, and we were able to flip the two.
Ah, networked.
And it was perfect. It was, you know, it was... And I feel very good about it, and we've, you know, had no complaints about people's pairings.
That's so interesting. And so then the artist basically got not only a poet, but a specific poem?
They got... I asked for four poems. I picked two. They got two, and they were to choose one and have even a phrase or a word. And some people, it's often obscured and you can't see the text, or some people have the whole poem. So there are booklets in the gallery and there's a wall of poetry so you can read the poems as you go through.
If you can't see it on the...
Mostly you can't, to tell you the truth. But it's interesting. Like, there might be one line. There's a line of Judith Hill's on this beautiful collage of Charles Greeley out of haiku paper. I mean, these are so... And Natalie Goldberg is paired with a young artist named Kuzana Ogg, who I've gotten to meet. So there have been friendships made and gifts given, and it's been truly extraordinary. So it's sort of the frosting on the cake of these 2 years.
It's such an interesting thing to do because it... I mean, I think for so many artists, poets or visual artists or anybody else, having a limitation saying, here's the space within which you have to work, can give rise to so much creativity.
It was challenging for people.
Yeah.
And some of them made more than one piece. And, it's very cool.
So this is Odes and Offerings, and it's at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center Gallery. And the opening of this has passed. We didn't make it in time for that, unfortunately.
Yes, but we had 600 people, give or take 200. It was the biggest opening they've ever had.
Amazing.
It was. I just sat handing out name tags. I couldn't even talk by the end of it. I was at the door handing out these tags for people. And but it's there, and there's... there's also a poet's reading area. I asked the poets if they wanted to display their books, and then people can order them from our local bookstores if they're not on stock. And you can sit and read from various poets, and I will donate all those books to a school at the end. I have their permission.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, would you like to tell us about your collaboration in this Odes and Offerings show?
Oh, yes. Bernadette Freeman is this most amazing collage artist. And I picked her because... I saw that she would use the whole... I had a feeling she'd use the whole poem. She uses text in her collage. And my poem is dedicated to W.S. Merwin. It's called Unpunctuated Awe. It's all there. It's in very tiny letters. I mean, collage to the 10th power. I mean, tiny little pieces of paper. And this beautiful landscape with a pear and these sort of wave shapes with my poem in it. It's incredible. She's lovely. And I really appreciate the work, the amazing work that went into that, the energy. And I think that's the idea of an offering is, you know, a gift given in this gift economy of the artists in Santa Fe. And that truly the poets surrendered their work to people they didn't know. Often you can't make out even a word, and they were very, very graceful about it. And Miriam said they released their poems to transformation.
Right.
You know, hers is really cool. Miriam's is... Edie Song, and it's an animation. And you can't make out any words, but it is utterly cool. It's this animated screen, Sarah Gordo poem.
It would be so interesting to ask each poet whether they felt like, starting with you, but whether they felt that the artworks contained the spirit of their poem.
So I know some people were so tickled on both sides. I mean, I'd had artists come up to me and saying, you have no idea, I've been in a block. And this really got me going, and I know her poet was very happy in this particular case. I think there were a lot of energetics that occurred.
And so people can see this. This is on view through the 8th of June.
Correct, and that's going to be sort of a finale reading that I will have. I wanted to say that if you go to the Santa Fe Arts Commission santafeartscommission.org, there's a Poet Laureate program and Poet Laureate events, and there are 6 free workshops and readings around this show.
Nice.
Too many to list here. But the final one on June 8th, I think they're going to announce the new Poet Laureate. We can't 100% promise, but we're aiming for that. And that'll be a farewell reading that I'll read from all this work that I've been accumulating as well.
Well, the next event, which we can talk about, is Friday, the 27th of April at 6 in the evening. And it's you, Valerie Martinez, and Arthur Z, the 3 poet laureates so far, right?
Uh-huh, that's right.
What are you going to be doing?
Okay, so that's one event that isn't at the Community Gallery. That's at the Museum of History.
The New Mexico History Museum Auditorium.
Yes, the auditorium. And we will I'm just saying that again so that people don't wander lost on a Friday night.
Right.
We'll each be reading from our work, okay. And it's a way of bringing focus to the program and launching the series of workshops also at the community gallery, because I'll be doing a free four-hour workshop the next day.
Yeah, so the next day from 12 to 4, there's a workshop that people, free workshop, yeah, beautiful, yeah, which people can sign up for.
And I'm really excited.
We're talking to Joan Logie, Santa Fe Poet Laureate. What about the next Poet Laureate? I know they were accepting applications or recommendations, whatever.
Until April 26th. Again, you can go to the Santa Fe Arts Commission website if you want to nominate somebody. Or you can go to the gallery, and they have forms there that explain the application.
Well, you know, I went there to look at it to see what is involved with nominating somebody, and it basically says send their resume and all this stuff, which you can't nominate somebody else. You know, you don't have access to their stuff, so they kind of have to be involved with it themselves.
Yes, you write a letter of nomination, and then they send resume, several, you know, certain amount of poems. They have to live. They took the. It used to be that you had to live or work in Santa Fe County for 2 years. It's gone up to 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And that was a decision the Arts Commission made. So
that's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. So
for those of us who have lived here for 20 and 30 years.
Oh, this week is my anniversary, 39 years.
Are you serious?
April 11th, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where are you from?
Pittsburgh.
But you have, I mean, do we ever become, I mean, I've been here for 22 years. Do we ever become New Mexicans?
No, my children were born here and my grandchildren, but I'm always going to be a Pittsburgher, even just the way I talk, I think. I've got that little twing.
Yeah, I wonder because, I mean, I don't know about you, but wild horses could not drag me back to the East Coast.
I like to go and see my family, but
yeah,
I live here. I will die here. You know, Morgan Farley has a beautiful poem about becoming a New Mexican. It's after you die and are buried, then you're really a New Mexican. You're accepted. You're local.
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't seen her for a long time.
Would you like to read a poem?
I will. And they did the sweetest thing. They have some of my poems on bookmarks at the gallery, so you can have some of my poems. This one was one, as I said, writing through the cycle of the year, and this one I wrote two Spanish markets ago. It was a drizzly day, and it's called At Spanish Market. I sit with Camila out of the rain, my dear friend of mica and clay, pots, earth, sky, money, music, chocolate cake at Zia, no mas and everything. Mañanitas from the bandstand sung by a child. Always one more major beauty in this plaza of drizzle and hanging flowers.
Joan Logie, Poet Laureate. I think the thing that one has to remember about poetry is, A, you have to hear it read aloud, and B, you have to read it over and over. The
yes.
second time. You want, read that one again.
Okay, I
just
like
for,
this one.
Yeah.
You know, Camila, you can see Camila at Farmer's Market every week selling her Tonita's hand bombs and foot bombs. She's
uh-huh.
a very dear friend of mine at Spanish Market. I sit with Camila out of the rain, my dear friend of mica and clay. Pots, earth, sky, money, music, chocolate cake at Zia, no mas and everything. Mañanitas from the bandstand sung by a child. Always one more major beauty in this plaza of drizzle and hanging flowers.
See, it's better the second time.
Oh, thank you. Well, I get into it. You know, memorizing poem is, we had to do that when I was young, and I still have those poems inside of me. Memorizing a poem, you go over and over, and it becomes part of you.
I know.
And even if you don't understand it, you understand it on that other level, the heart level.
We learned, we had to memorize them too, and my friend and I would also say them in Pig Latin.
Mischief was afoot.
bad even then. So, odes and offerings. So what are you going to do when you pass your tiara on?
You mean post-Poet Laureate stress syndrome?
Yeah.
Or I have some things going on. I mean, I will garden. I will be with my grandkids. I have a lot of other writing that I need to pay attention to. Something always happens. Something percolates, and I do the next thing. I'm a little concerned.
But, yeah, because you basically go back into private life. It's like leaving office.
Yeah, I'm going back to civilian life after public. So it'll be interesting. But, you know, Valerie and Arthur did fine, and they will approach me.
Yeah, continue to do
life
lots
goes
of
on.
Things. I was wondering about how basically being a poet, working as a poet, having poetry be maybe the essential guiding principle in your life, how that affects how you live. In other words, it seems like there's probably an analogy to people who practice meditation or people who have any discipline in their life, but it's a specific kind of discipline.
Yeah, I think you're right. First of all, I always feel like whatever I'm doing, I could be writing about it. So there's a little bit of a tension built into daily life. But ever since I got a typewriter again, I feel so much better because I can go in and type something up. I think poetry.
A typewriter?
I have two manuals and an electric typewriter.
Are you kidding me?
And my electric typewriter is in my office, my messy office, and I go in and I type very often in the middle of the night, whenever. And that is, I love that so much. I've been doing that since I was a teenager on a typewriter, and it just, I don't know, puts me into sort of a little bit trance state, you know, and I just type, and I never know what's going to come out.
What if you were to do the same thing on a computer?
It's different, Mary Charlotte. I don't know how to say it. It's just, the Eros is different.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
You see it right away on the paper. I don't know. And it's... But there is that feeling about writing is available, and there's also, like, trying to let the shoulds go away and just know, I'll keep writing. And sometimes I don't, but I write a lot.
Poetry, all art, is a reflection of society. Society changes, perhaps less in New Mexico than in other places in the world in some ways. But when you think about how you've been doing this all most of your life, when you think about how your own work has evolved in relation to the world around you, what kind of changes do you see?
My own work versus the world around me. I'm not super political, although I will put... You know, when there's a war, I'm writing about it. I think the world is speeding, and writing is slowing, and that it's probably always been that way for me. But I think, A, as I get older, B, as technology makes everything so instantaneous, and even editing is, you know, so much easier, the cut and paste. I used to clip together all the drafts of the poem, typewritten. So I think it's a lot about time and speed that maybe the differences...
Do you feel pressured to work faster?
I feel like life is faster and that I'm, you know, things are speeding by. But I think I'm sort of the same. I have my ebbs and flows and my, oh my, I'll never write again moments that I complain to my friends and they look at me and go, we've heard that one before.
There is a gratitude that I feel for having grown up in the pre-internet era,
yes.
Because I know I would have been a total addict of that thing,
yes,
as a kid, looking stuff up and playing games and things like that. And as it was, we had basically nothing else to do, but it sounds so Norman Rockwell, but sled, play softball,
and imagine
play
what,
outside.
What W.S. Merwin was talking about is imagine. I mean, I have three grandkids who are completely screen drawn,
yeah,
and screen dominated, and I think that's one of the reasons I like to show up live in a school as the old model and have things memorized and have things with music and show that there's life that's juicy outside of technology. It's very important to me.
You teach at a school here in Santa Fe, and you've also been working with kids in your capacity as poet laureate. Do you see some of these kids catching fire through poetry?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Not so much when I do a one-time visit, but at Santa Fe Girls' School, I mean, there are students that I've worked with that have gotten masters, two of them that I can think of that are master degree in creative writing. And
oh, my, because you've been doing it so long, they grow up and go to college. And
yeah. I mean, they might have done it anyhow, but it makes me feel happy. And there are a lot of them, they say, you know, poetry really saved my life. Thank you so much for doing this. And Santa Fe Girls' School, it's been just wonderful. 12 years there.
Were just about out of time. Would you like to go out with one more poem?
I would be delighted.
We're talking to Joan Logie.
Okay. Okay, so this one is a little love poem for our dry, beloved New Mexico. Just when we give up on gardens, the rains kick in. Sunflower from bird feeder seed, leaves big as elephant's ears. This jungle desert breaks my heart with heat and wind, breaks it with beauty again and again. Like you do, darling. Be with me at sunset and sunrise, just when we give up.
Joan Logie, Poet Laureate of Santa Fe, for another couple of months. It's just great to have you on the air, and let's remind people, or if people just tuned in, Odes and Offerings is a collaborative poetry and art exhibition which is at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center through the 8th of June of this year. There's all sorts of events and workshops happening. You can go to the Santa Fe Arts Commission website, santafeartscommission.org. And Joan, it's just great to have you on the air, and we'll have you again even when you're not Poet Laureate.
Thank you so much.
And I'd like now to welcome Lauren Camp. She's a poet and artist. She's a DJ on KSFR. Her program on Sundays at 5 in the afternoon is called Audio Saucepan. And she will be reading this Sunday, the 15th of April, from 3 to 4 in the afternoon at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation on West Barcelona here in Santa Fe. The reading is called The Need to Return, Four Writers on Family and Heritage. It's Lauren Camp and also Margaret Randall, Elaine Maria Upton, and Richard Vargas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Wonderful to be here, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you. Now, this question about heritage is just endlessly fascinating because I think we as Americans are continually in danger of losing our heritage or feeling like we're losing our heritage. And we try to understand who we are through heritage. And I was wondering what your process was like in this respect.
Well, and also for virtually every one of us, our heritage is not here in the United States. It goes back to some other place or many other places. So my heritage on my father's side, which is what I'm going to be dealing with on the for the reading on Sunday, is Iraqi. When I was a child, and I'm familiar with it, I know it to some extent. I grew up with it around me. And when I...
Was he born there?
He was born in Baghdad and left for the United States in 1950. He was 15.
Ah.
And I knew all of that. And that's about where it ended. That's about where my knowledge ended, where he said, and this was the date we came to the United States. And because there was never a reason to ask why, because it was somehow, he didn't say, don't ask me any questions, but it was somehow just not the thing we did. I never thought to wonder, why would somebody leave their homeland? I mean, I was a little girl. That just didn't occur to me. Why would you leave a country, come around the world, and start again? Until just a few years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
So when you were in your teens or early 20s, it never occurred to you to ask
never.
Him.
So I feel like there must have been some kind of like invisible wall that said, don't ask about that. But I don't know.
Now, did you end up actually interviewing him or talking to him?
Not really. So I've created a manuscript that is still in progress, but that is about his childhood in Baghdad. My dad's alive and well. He's happy. He's healthy. And he doesn't say anything about it.
Real? Does he know you're doing this?
Sort of. That's a really complicated area to go into. But I thought he just didn't want to answer the questions. And then it turned out that just last year when I was probing gently, like, who was your English teacher? Or how did you get to school? Or anything. I found that there were lots of things he didn't remember. And I think that's now where that wall has moved to. If there was a time that he knew the answers, he no longer does.
So what kinds of questions were you and are you interested in knowing?
So the real crux of it, what really got me started, is something called the Farhud, which was a two-day event that happened in Baghdad in 1941, June 1941. And it was effectively raping, looting, pillaging, killing of the Jewish population. My dad would have been six.
And Jewish.
And from a Jewish family. Jewish on both sides. And the Jews in Iraq were a large population at that point. So I didn't know anything about this. And yet my dad had been sending me articles by email for years. These long, like pages and pages of articles about the Farhud. And that's what it would say. And I would sort of look at them and look at the length and say, I'll read this later. And never any message about it. One day I sat down and started looking at it, and I had so many of these articles, and that's when I put it together. He was six. His childhood probably wasn't happy. Not that day, and not before that either. So I started looking into the whole history of the country based, like, in that time period that he would have been a child, a young man, a teenager, what it must have been like. And that was really what started me. I have gotten tiny bits of information from my father. He told me what street they lived on, the number and the name of the street, Batawin Street. And I was fascinated by that. That became something real that I could grab onto. And I went to the internet, found maps of Baghdad from that time period, 1940s, and looked it up. And there it was, Batawin Street. And I could say, here's where he was in relation to the river. Here's where he was in relation to this and that. Of course, the city is now completely different. But so the tiny things he was able to give me, I was able to then go further and research and put together my own sense of what might have been going on, what his childhood might have been like.
I mean, if he was sending you these emails, it sounds like he wanted you to ask.
I think so. But then when I asked, he didn't answer. And he didn't answer anything. You know, I would ask, and he would sort of push my emails or my questions off to his cousins or just ignore them.
Like, Dad, why did you leave Iraq and come to the United States?
And nothing. He would, no, nothing. So it became sort of this weird game, and at some point it became, I'm bothering him. Like, he's actually unhappy with me for asking. And last year I realized, he's unhappy because he doesn't remember. Because I'm pushing against something that doesn't exist there anymore. So
you are doing something which you can't really call memoir, biography, or documentary, because you don't actually have any solid information. It's like a work of, or very little. So it's a work of imagination.
It's sort of a combination of everything. And then add to it that it's all written in poetry.
Right.
So it's part memoir. So I'm interviewing cousins. I'm talking to and reading books. I'm looking at maps. I'm looking at photos. I'm looking at timelines, genealogy stuff that our larger family has posted. But yeah, it's part fiction. It's part imagined. It's not fiction, really. It's imagined, which I think is different.
Would you like to read one of your poems?
Sure.
We're talking to Lauren Camp.
Letter to Baghdad. Even if my father never speaks a word of it, I will know he brought a candle, a cough, and the occupied side of his heart. I will know the trees held him, that they rose above roof lines, and where they met he climbed and saw roads paved only with praises. The sun he carried across oceans turned copper at his window. I saw it too, on the gray edge of my childhood, and I was marked when each day awoke. He devoured the silence, the parts that could not be cured, and when he was hungry for it, I swallowed the silence, his self-portrait of confession. When I found an old shawl and silver teapot in the oven and he pretended he didn't know what they meant, I remembered bitter lemons had moistened his mouth. What he inhaled from his copious memory left his tongue empty, then full, and somehow I know his tongue will always be brushed with the leaving. One day, we were talking about beginnings, and I had begun. I wasn't at the center anymore, but we kept letting in a little air, and he showed me a word for the boy he once was. And he showed me this Arabic word, and in this way I knew this was the most authentic morning I would ever see. And I saw it, and he said it again, and we were covered with it, entirely covered. This was his home, he said, as he gave me the address, the place where the first time and the spurned and the color and the milkmaid stood in the alley. And even though he didn't tell me about yesterday and the day, and I never saw any other way to tell it, I never saw heaven or the land that was black. One day I knew enough to take the word from him and drink my fill of everything, every little thing, every steeped thing. And there were many trees and not enough cold. And we sat by the river that curves in every direction, and our hearts lifted up to the birds.
Lauren Camp, reading from a collection of poems, and you'll be reading this and many others.
From this collection.
From this
strictly,
collection.
Yeah.
On
Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation.
So the question of knowing the details about one's parents, about one's ancestors, which so many of us ask, particularly those of us, I think, who have immigrant parents and immigrant grandparents, how does it fill you, how does it complete you in a way that wasn't there before you embarked on this kind of work?
The question of knowing your parent is actually really intriguing because I don't know more about my dad from doing all this research. A couple of years of research now. I don't actually know more directly from him, and I think the fact that I, at first that's frustrating. What, you know, he could just give me the information and then I could have it and I could write it in my poetic, whatever, tone and style and line. But he didn't do that. And that forced me to collect bits and pieces and to imagine his story. Firstborn male in a Jewish family, one of my dad's cousins told me he was the prince of that family because he was that firstborn male. And that led me off in a new direction. So I feel like I'm not sure this answers your question exactly, but I feel like I'm given these tiny little gems and they sort of glow from places and I take them and I run with them and I make them into something larger. And in a way that gives me a lot more appreciation for my dad, who is very tight-lipped about it.
So here we have a relationship between our country and Iraq, which has not been very pretty over the last few years. I mean, invasion, occupation of a country for bogus reasons we know in retrospect, and we really knew then if we had our eyes open. How does that affect your relationship to the whole subject of your own heritage, if it does?
Well, it doesn't affect my dad's relationship at all. He's pretty much stayed out of the whole current events scene.
That's amazing.
Amazing. And more complicated on a different level. But it affects me in that as a child, I would say, my dad's from Iraq. You know, when teachers would say, you know, we're doing heritage today.
And, right.
You know, you need to know where your mother's from, where your father's from. My dad's from Iraq, or we're celebrating this thing, or this food that I brought in is, you know, this is tamarind, and nobody knew what it was. And I would be so proud of that, and nobody knew what Iraq was or where it was. And now, of course, that's totally different. Now it's in the news all the time. And so in a way, I feel like I lost this special little secret thing that I owned, which was this connection to this country.
Do you feel that, how should I say this, parts of Iraqi culture have filtered into your life in various ways?
The language, even though I don't speak it, I don't understand it, the sound of the language is a part of my body.
Did you
somehow.
You heard it?
I heard
up.
It. I yeah. heard it. Yeah. We would spend time. My grandparents came. My father's whole family, his siblings and his parents came, right around the same time. My dad came a few weeks later, and we would spend pretty much once every 3 weeks with my grandparents. So that I heard the language all around me, the prayers, the food. So all of that is definitely in me somehow.
You are an artist. you work in so many different forms. You do the DJing at KSFR, if you can call that an art form, but you work as a fiber artist, so you're a visual artist. You work in poetry, which is a literary and almost musical form.
Right.
How do you bring these things together? Is the visual art part of this particular heritage project?
Not at all. Actually, I'm thinking. I don't think I've done anything. What I've done in fabric more is jazz related, music related, and self portraits and images of women. But no, for a long time it was like the three things, and I do consider radio an art form. The three things were entirely separate. They were like each their own circles, and they were far from each other. And then they started blending. Like there would be overlaps between certain things. But no, the visual art, I never did try to bring the Iraqi heritage in at all.
Interesting.
I never really thought about it before. Yeah, it's more like something comes to me, something that I want to do, and the medium comes at the same time. Like, oh, okay, a poem would be the easiest way to say this. Not that it would be easy, but it would be the way that
the right way
that I could ultimately challenge myself to say it. And visual art never felt like the right fit for that.
Interesting. We're talking to poet and artist Lauren Camp. So you'll be reading from this set of poems on Sunday. The event is called The Need to Return, Four Writers on Family and Heritage. How did you four come together?
The Unitarian Church asked me to do an event as part of their Drama on Barcelona series. And I decided I wanted to do something on family and heritage because that was where I was thinking. That was where my energies were going. And I immediately started thinking about who else I could involve in the event. Ultimately, I invited three other writers who all said yes. They're phenomenal writers. All of them are poets. Two of them are reading stories, though. Richard Vargas is reading a story about his child, sort of a creative nonfiction memoir piece about his childhood in Compton, California. Margaret Randall, who was raised partly in New York and partly in Albuquerque, is reading stories about, I think, about both places and also about some of her relatives and imagined realities. And Elaine Upton is reading about her literary ancestors. She's sort of taken the characters from The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and continued that story after the novel ends.
And so all four of you will be reading on Sunday. What a great event.
It's going to be fantastic. I've been excited to hear them. I actually requested the two stories. I had either heard or read them, and I begged those writers to come and read. So
they needed begging?
No. Well, I mean, they both said yes, but I was just like, please read this specific thing.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Now, you, along with everything else you do, and you're a very busy gal, are teaching, you're doing various kinds of teaching, including helping people to write their own memoirs.
That's right.
That's a very interesting process.
It's fabulous. I mean, it's because the people who are writing memoirs and stuck don't have the confidence to continue. And I'm able to help them sort of chunk it down, break it down to small stories, anecdotes, and begin to tell that story and begin to assemble it with the help of effectively a coach or a buddy who can, you know, who can pick out things and say, go further. This is interesting. Go, you know, and deal with the grammar and deal with the storyline.
The grammar.
Very
important.
Yeah.
Now, I think memoir is such an interesting form because it's become very, very popular.
Everybody wants to tell their story.
Everyone wants to tell their story, but I don't know about you. I don't want to read everybody's story. And so the question of, I mean, I think there are memoirs that should be written for the sake of the family.
That's
right. That the children and grandchildren can read them. And there are memoirs that should be written for the sake of all mankind.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking about this, how a memoir a life story that is basically peaceful and happy doesn't really have a humongous audience. People want to read about abuse and difficult situations, and maybe those are the memoirs that really make it to the top 10 best-selling books, but I do think everybody has a story that is valid. Everybody has a life that is valid, and so everybody should be allowed to tell that story, and maybe you're right. Maybe it doesn't go further than family.
Well, there's abuse and there's difficulty, but there's also then people who've actually done something. I mean, I had the great privilege of interviewing Robert J. Lifton last year. He wrote a memoir about his whole life, and his whole life was connected with the life of some of the great events on this planet, right, starting with the dropping of the atomic bomb in Hiroshima.
Right. So yes, then there's the, you know, how does history fit around you? How do you fit into history? And it's been just exciting work to work with writers, all sorts of writers, emerging writers just doing creative writing, and then these other writers who are working on memoirs.
Now, you also do this show on audio called Audio Saucepan on KSFR, and I know people miss you because you used to do The Colors of Jazz from 9 to 12 on Monday mornings and became a fixture on KSFR for years and years, and now you're doing this Sunday afternoon show, which is more than jazz.
It's way more than jazz. It's world music. It's everything. And it's poetry. And it's not my poetry, which is sort of great to be able to pick several poems for the week and use my voice to share them with listeners. You know, use that medium of radio to mix the music and the poems, the words, and really get a sort of composite of sounds. But yeah, the music is all over the globe. It's whatever I'm interested in that week.
Do you sort of go all over the place, or do you choose things that fit together, or how does that work?
They fit together for me. I guess it's sort of the same. This is where the circles overlap, where the fiber art overlaps. I always thought certain colors went together just because they felt good inside me. I would put them together and I would get this certain feeling. And so music is sort of the same for me. It's like the music has colors and they, or beats or whatever, and they work together. And I could go, if those segues are right, I could go from one genre into something completely different. And ideally the listener will go along with me.
Lauren Camp, would you like to read another poem?
Sure, I'd be glad to. I'm going to read a poem from my book. The poem's called My First Year, and so in a way it's family and heritage again. It goes back to my parents when I was young. My First Year. In 1967, my mother is already my mother, in the seedy, boiled metal of Manhattan, below the women's fancy clothing at Macy's Herald Square, where she works and buys her clothes. In 1967, my mother has stopped her cigarettes. The U.S. blasts through operations Latchkey and Crosstie with tests named Bourbon, Persimmon, Fizz, Cerise, and Polka, apt descriptions of my mother's vibrant outfits. And my little wrinkled body stretches out. My father bathes my hot pink flesh in a plastic tub. John and Paul sing Penny Lane. We wander to the park at 4th and Waverly, my mother in coral bell-bottoms and a yellow blouse. Returning home, she sips rosé, satisfied. In 1967, NBC argues the Vietnam War, a frenzy of race riots. My parents too busy to listen. What they don't hear keeps climbing away. My father watches the first Super Bowl as a married man. Peggy Fleming skates in a formal ice rink dressed in pink, my mother's eyes entranced. My mother buys a charming pea coat for her 5'10 frame. Sex oozes onto streets and down alleys. Neil Armstrong practices landing on the moon. In 1967, everyone drops acid while my father goes to work. From the couch, my parents watch Milton Berle. My mother lands in the city of humor and stays there smiling as the show keeps ending. In 1967, my mother drags my cradle to the TV set. Fred Rogers walks us through the neighborhood and my mother grits her teeth. Fred teaches make-believe while my mother organizes her pretty clothing. What is happening isn't happening in my house.
Lauren Camp, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
And we'll see you on Sunday at 3 o'clock at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation.